It's time for a Big Blue Kickoff Live.
Nobody can ever tell you that you couldn't do it, because you did.
On Giants.com.
You know what I saw? New York Giant Prime.
And the Giants mobile app.
We'll punch you in the nose for 60 minutes with a relentless, competitive attitude.
Part of the Giants Podcast Network.
Let's go out there like a bunch of crazy dogs and have some fun.
Welcome to Friday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com and the Giants mobile app. John Schmelk, Lance Medow, and Paul Dottino with you. The phone number is 973-667-1960. We'll take your calls in the second half of the show, because first we're going to have our guest, former NFL personnel guy, and now the guy who runs the Scouting Academy, teaching and training NFL scouts. That's Dan Hatman. But first, I want to remind everybody you can find the Giants Huddle podcast on the Giants Podcast Network, along with Big Blue Kickoff Live, of course, the show you're listening to right now, which is presented by Investors Bank. You can find it at Giants.com/podcast, your Giants mobile app, and at Giants.com/podcast. And now let's welcome in our guest. His name is Dan Hatman. He's a former NFL personnel guy, and of course, he now trains people heading into the NFL to be scouts. Dan, you got John Schmelk, Paul Dottino, Lance Medow with you here in New Jersey, in New York. Are you up in Albany, man? How are you?
I am. I'm still up here in training, old training camp grounds, enjoying it.
Great. Thank you for being with us, Dan. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome to the program. I'll start here. I'm going to keep it really basic and really simple. If there's one thing that sticks out to you about this year's draft class for the 2021 NFL draft, what is it?
It's a big man's game, and O-line is an area where you can really make some hay in the early going here. And then in most of these premium positions, there's substantial drop-off. So you gotta pay attention to what you need early on.
With respect to the offensive line, Dan, I want to piggyback off of that point because of the fact that the Giants could very well target an offensive lineman at number 11. When you have a player, for example, like Rashawn Slater, who has been a tackle, some project him to maybe be moved on the inside, how difficult is that from a scouting perspective to project whether or not a guy is going to be effective at a position he hasn't played much?
It certainly is a challenge when you get away from apples to apples, but you have to go back into then what does it take to play guard? And you really just start looking for transferable traits and what would build up. When you move inside, the processing speed has to increase. Things happen faster. There's more options coming from more places. Hand timing and placement becomes really critical. When you're on the edge, it takes a little while for that rusher to get to you. I mean, you are on an island, but there's some space. You're inside, there's very little space, right? So all that stuff speeds up, and again, the timing, the accuracy really have to be there. So if you're going to project a player inside, to me, it's not just because of arm length or something like that. A lot of it from a successful transfer inside is going to come from processing and their ability to use your hands.
Dan, how much of a shady glance are you looking at these pro days with? I mean, when guys go to the combine, and we all understand it's the underwear Olympics and it's the least important of all the evaluations, the film will always be number one. But at the same time, at the combine, at least you have some guys who will disappoint in a number of areas. Whether or not it's weighed heavily is not really the point that I want to make with you. I think the problem with these pro days is, as we've talked to guys around the country, every single stat that's coming out of these pro days is a positive. Not one guy has disappointed in any way, shape, or form, which to me totally destroys the credibility of these things.
There is a marketing angle to it, there's no doubt. And the information flow is a little bit different than when you have it centralized. And, you know, an event like the Combine where you're going through multiple days of interviews and mental testing and the physicals and all that stuff, and you finally get to the field, right? So it's this this mini marathon for everybody involved. And so you're also looking at a player under a level of duress by the end of the combine when they actually get on field. And so to wipe all that away, you put them in a more comfortable environment. They don't have to go through batteries of testing ahead of time. They're doing the things that they're comfortable with the people they're comfortable with and a place they're comfortable with. I can't say I'm surprised that things are turning out better. But at the same time, we've got more tools at our disposal now to actually measure athletic ability on film than we've had in the past. And so there's ways of bypassing solely relying on these combine numbers and mm-hmm. still being able to see how a player performed on film.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting when you take a look at that and you make that consideration, Dan. So I guess my second question for you then, following up on that, is when you look at some of the guys this year at the top of the class at those positions where you're really concerned with the athletic timing, the wide receivers, the cornerbacks, guys like that, how do you compare this class to recent classes, especially when it comes to the wide receivers? Is this as good of a crop at the top as we've seen in the last few years?
You know, you start looking at wide receiver over the last decade, and we've seen how the growth of the passing game as it's gone through all the levels of football, you know, including the high school level. You know, most people that used to play the game were in some sort of wishbone or triple option or what have you coming up, and, you know, we run the ball. Well, so much of the game, again, at every level is passing. We have these 7-on-7 camps. So as people have gotten to the college level and now they're coming in the league, they have so many more routes under their belt. They have so much more time in passing offenses under their belt. The polish is so much greater. So I believe that we're getting to a point with position like receiver where it used to be rare to find a height, weight, speed, polished receiver early on. Now you're finding them into the third round just because of how many guys have gotten those reps and have developed that part of their game before they arrive at the NFL level. So when we look at top 100 picks over the last few years, we're continuing to see that. We're going to continue to see that again at wide receiver this year. There's going to be guys in day two that are going to have really good NFL careers. And so I think what it's going to do is it's going to push the board down a little bit there because you feel like you can get that later where you can't get some of these other positions later. Like, I don't believe that corner is going to have the same level of success later into the draft that you'll have at wide receiver.
Dan, how fair do you think it is that these opt-out players – for whatever reason, the guys opted out. That's not really the issue here. But how much projection has to be done for these guys who, had they stayed in and been part of their programs and had all of those extra games and all those extra reps and snaps, could have put further development on field so that you guys as scouts would be able to ascertain exactly what they think they were going to get coming out of the draft? Have a lot of these guys really lost a lot of luster because of that in your mind?
It doesn't seem like it. It doesn't seem like when you start talking to people about top players at these different positions, there's a lot of names that were opt-outs still up there and not really getting bypassed by others. You know, so the top tackles, you got opt-outs. Top linebackers, you got opt-outs. Some of the top rushers, you've got some opt-outs. And so really hasn't seemed to have as much of an impact as I think it may have. But I think everything with the last 13, 14 months here has been such a whirlwind and no one really knows how to account for all of it that it seems like you're just turning on that 2019 tape and treating it as if it was 2020, verifying that they're staying in shape. You know, those are the guys you're going to pay attention to a little bit more of where they're at and how they're moving right now because you didn't get a chance to see them just a couple months ago. But you're staying in touch, and I'm sure the agents were filming things and have a library of that kind of stuff available that, you know, you could tap into. And
Let me ask you this before you go further there. Let me ask you this. Let me take you into the scout's head for a second, because obviously you know all about this kind of mentality. The scout can say, well, I told you this guy was this, this, and this. I watched his 2019 tape. He opted out. All right. So it didn't work out so well. The opt out is my alibi.
Yeah,
you see what I'm getting at now.
I wouldn't be surprised to see people try to do some revisionist history, but that's the nature of, I think, any human in a prediction business, which is all scouting is. You're trying to predict the future performance of a human being. And when it doesn't work out, did you document how you arrived at it and use that to measure? Or is it just going to be kind of that fluffy memory bank? I left myself some wiggle room. I'm just a bigger fan in documenting how you arrive at a decision and what you factored in, what assumptions you made. And if you made the assumption that it was no big deal to have an opt-out and it bites you, the next time that comes up, maybe you'll adjust. But we don't have a lot of evidence going into this of how to modify things with these opt-outs because we really haven't dealt with it before.
You know, Dan, I want to follow up to that real quickly because a couple of these out-outs, and I'm talking about specifically Penei Sewell and Ja'Marr Chase, the last time we saw them, they were dominant players. As sophomores at 19 years old, oftentimes playing against guys that are 2 or 3 years older than them, as a scout, how much do you look at that and say, wow, look what this guy did at 19. Can you imagine what he's going to look like at 22, 25, and then try to project a little bit that way when you're looking at specifically the age at which they performed at that high level?
I look at every player on a development curve, right? It's not linear. It's not like every year they play, they get better. We don't see that with human beings. Some guys take steps back. Some take huge steps forward. Some take incremental steps forward.
Sure.
So I'm always looking at it relative to the environment that they were in, the resources and the coaching that they were given. If they were given really high-level coaching, like Sewell's O-line coaches at Oregon are some of the most renowned guys in the industry. So he should have come along, right? He's been with top-tier coaching. It's no different than the years that Notre Dame kept producing Zach Martin and Ronnie Stanley and Quentin Nelson, all those guys. Well, they had Harry Hastings, you know, who's a phenomenal offensive line coach. So it kind of comes with the territory. So if you saw a player like that that might have been getting ahead of things even in his environment, I think that stands out a little differently. I'm happy to see that those guys produced in those areas, but I don't think I'm giving them quite as much credit as others are that the next step for them is going to be an exponential leap forward.
Dan, you just brought up some interesting points with respect to if a player worked with maybe an offensive line coach or positional coach that has a good track record. I would also bring into the equation when you're on campuses, you have the opportunity to speak to members of the training staff, members of the coaching staff, which I'm sure is just as critical as watching the film and breaking things down. So on top of the fact that players have opted out, when you consider all the challenges that COVID has provided from a scouting perspective and not maybe having access to as many face-to-face resources as you would normally have in previous years, how challenging does that make evaluating some of these players in terms of your access to people who may not even have to do with the X's and O's?
That's been the absolute biggest pain proposition. Film is digital, right? We can get film put on our iPad and sliced and diced in a million different ways in a heartbeat. So watching film isn't what it used to be. You don't have to go to campus to watch film anymore. So when you go to campus, it's about all the things you just talked about. It's about the people there, and when you get on a Zoom call with 32 other teams and answer questions there, it's almost like being in a deposition. You're not getting insight, and it's really hard to activate on your sources when it's open to everybody. You got to get those one-off calls, and you got to get them to spend extra time with you on the side and things of that nature. To me, this year is a case study in how you built your scouting department. If you're relying on a bunch of new people, they don't have a lot of time in their areas and didn't build up some of those sources, and then they're going to have a really hard time differentiating on, you know, the football character and the personal character. Whereas if you've got a much more tenured group of people, particularly in their area, I think that's going to make a huge impact this year in being able to split those differences.
Dan, let me ask you this. In some cases, like with the Giants, they've got a relatively young coaching staff with a lot of connections to the NCAA ranks, guys who have either been there within the last year or two. Look, I know organizations always want to be symmetric. They want the, you know, personnel department, scouting department, coaches, they all want to go after the same kind of players. They understand what the organization wants out of certain prospects. But do you expect that because of the situation that we're in now, where so much needs to be learned about these prospects and there isn't as much firsthand eyewitness accounts, that scouts will be relying a little bit more on teams that have assistant coaches with NCAA pipelines?
There was, when I was in Philly, I was there for the transition of Chip Kelly in, and he brought in a guy named Joe Panunzio. And Joe's one of those guys that knows everybody in college football. You know, he's got the Rolodex. And I remember saying to myself, like, man, what a smart hire to have a guy in your building that when you have a, you know, I got a question on this, he knows somebody, right? He's got the number, he goes right to him. imagine what that's like. And so I think it's a huge advantage right now to have a staff full of people that can make those phone calls and go right there. Because we're just saying the scouts may have a harder time than they used to. But if your coaching staff can dip in and fill that up because they have those connections, they know those people, I think that's going to be huge.
Dan, this is a generic question and maybe it's different by position group. Feel free to answer it any way you want. How do you adjust grades and adjust player preference based on the guy that you've seen production from, you like his technique specifically? And, you know, I'll look at it this way. You have a guy like Aziz Ojolari, right? This is just an example. You don't have to answer these two players specifically. He's 8.5 sacks. He's shown what he can do off the edge. You know, maybe doesn't have the best measurables per se in terms of size. Then you look at a guy like Jason Oweh, who had no sacks last year, not a lot of production, but he, you know, destroys every physical event you can imagine. And when you watch him on tape, he looks like a physical freak too, right? Which is the most important thing. So when you get into that draft room and you're putting grades on and you're evaluating these guys, how much do you say our coaches can teach technique? They can turn those physical talents into NFL production? Or how much do you say, well, I want to pick the guy that I know is a great football player right now, even if maybe those physical talents aren't as elite as this guy that's a little bit more raw? How do you balance that when you hit that draft room and you start stacking players and making those final evaluations?
I would say the scouting community on the whole probably leans a little more towards the things you can't buy. Go get those traits, those rare abilities, and hope for development. Probably a little more than coaches, because scouts usually have a longer view when it comes to those things, and coaches are playing for their jobs right now.
Sure.
So to me, it's all about, can you accurately self-scout? Do you know if your people can develop? Are you just hoping they can, right? I imagine there's not too many staffs where if you ask the coach, hey, can you train this? They're going to say no.
No, of course not. In fact, every all coach right? is going to be like, hey, give me that 4-3 athlete, I'll turn him into a star, right?
So if you got 32 staffs and every staff thinks that every coach can teach everything, no problems, then we know there's failure in that because players don't always develop.
Correct.
So how are you looking and assessing internally where you're at? Like, I had one team I talked to a couple years ago. Their receiver coach was like an O-line coach by trade, but he was really good at scheme, X's nose, helped the OC build game plans. And so he could teach the receivers what we're going to do schematically. I need you here. I need you here, what have you. But he was not like a technical coach. He was not teaching the nuances the same way.
He isn't teaching releases.
He's
not going to teach releases and things like things of that nature, right?
Yeah. So they had made the decision that based on that profile, they were actually going to target polished receivers in the draft who had already gotten that, because this coach will get them where they need to be, but not how to get from point A to point B, just where to go. And I like that awareness because I think it allows you to have better strategy than just, oh, no, we'll develop them, no problem. And then when it falls on its face, everyone's turning around and pointing fingers.
That's a great point.
Dan, last one from me, and it kind of goes off of the topic that you just talked about. With so many of these players who have done the opt-outs and with so many projections of what these guys are going to be, I don't know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 4 years from now, how patient are these clubs going to have to be with that selection of players, understanding that because they did not have as much seasoning, it is going to take some more time to bring out the best in them?
And by the way, might not have an off-season program too, Paul, in person.
No question, John.
So when I was getting trained up in the business, it was always a 3-year lens, right? Where are they going to be by year 3? And the last 5 years have really changed that. We're at like by year 2. Right, so first year, you don't get the off season. You barely get training camp. We're into it. You're off and running. Everybody kind of understands that. But then you get your full off season going into year 2. And by training camp of year 2, for picks in the top 100, there's an expectation about either starting or competing to start. And so the timeline, I think, has moved up by an entire year on these players because of what teams want to get out of the rookie contract while it's slotted. We need the bang for the buck now. And so that the timeline of, oh, well, he's raw, we'll figure it out, is a harder profile to put a lot of weight in your draft process unless your room's already stopped. Like, if you know how you're going to go put your guys in the field, and you're going to add one more piece, it doesn't matter when he comes along, just that he comes along,
mm-hmm.
so be it. But if you're looking for, like, we need a starter for September, to take a raw player, it's just a hard thing to get into because, again, we're moving that timeline way down.
So that's more business-oriented, though, because of the rookie contracts and the economics of the cap? Or is that more impacted by just the impatience of, we need a guy to be able to produce quickly?
Probably a little column A, column B, but I'd lean towards the former. I think the money side of it's hard because, you know, we're going to have the new TV deal, right? So the contracts now coming into, when these rookies come up, you know, we're going to see an increase on the contract side. And so it just starts, you just have to price yourself out of players potentially, unless you have other guys who can perform again on a slotted deal. And so that movement has really changed things.
Dan, on a related note to that, especially when you look at how the rookie contract is structured for first round picks and you've got the 4-year deal and the 5th-year option, how much perhaps does the mindset of the first round pick differ from guys that you would take in the second to the third round? And what I mean by that is, of course, you're always looking for an impactful player, but couldn't you argue you have a little bit more leeway by having the 5th-year option on the first round pick? So maybe if you did want to take a guy in a year like this where there's some questions, you have at least some more flexibility to develop him because of the length of that contract.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially at the premium positions, you know, to have a little more control. I think it's why you see teams trade up in the back end of the first round for quarterbacks, you know, have an option there in the 5th year. I've even heard some people discuss doing that on a running back that you may not want to do a second contract with, but get that 5th year controlled. So there's been discussions about how to use that first round pick to give yourself some extra flexibility for sure.
Unfortunately, Dan, these running backs hold out now before they get to that 5th-year option. So I appreciate your plan. It just hasn't worked out very well recently. Dan, great stuff, my friend. We really appreciate the time. Welcome to the Big Blue Kickoff Live family. We'll definitely have you on again as we move forward. Tell the folks where they can find you and what you're up to.
You can find me on Twitter at Dan_Hatman. And you can find us at scoutingacademy.com. And we are online education service for those that want to learn more about football.
Dan, great stuff, my friend. Let's talk soon. Enjoy the next couple weeks leading up to the draft.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Dan Hatman, former NFL personnel guy, Giants, Eagles, Jets, worked in a couple of front offices there. And, of course, as you mentioned, training scouts over at the Scouting Academy. Make sure you guys go check that out. We're going to have Kentley Platt. You guys know him as MathBomb on Twitter. And he does all the relative athletic scores, which is basically a compilement of all the physical attributes and testing for players. And he puts them on a scale based on all the players that have been tested. Since I think he's back to 1987 now, Paul. And he kind of ranks them and puts them up there. So he'll be the perfect guy to talk to figure out how much we can trust these pro days, which is a conversation we've been having. Because he has the data, and he'll be able to tell us exactly how much, if at all, this year's numbers are, in fact, inflated or not. In the meantime, we got about 5 minutes before Kent. So, guys, if you want to get in on the phones, you can. 973-667-1960. Lance, if you want to hide in your closet from the cops, I understand. We can get back to you in a few minutes. That's
okay.
I'm not
too concerned.
You're
okay? It's just a busy day in NYC.
Yes, absolutely. So, guys, we are at the under the 3-week mark now to day one of the NFL draft. It's closing in. This is when teams are getting together and really putting their boards together because all the pro days now are over, and you're going to get those final stackings of players. And we're really heading into the home stretch here. This is really when the fun begins. And this, to me, guys, you know, the mock drafts we've had fun with the last month or so, the ones that come out now in the next 2 or 3 weeks, there's still going to be lies, there's still going to be smoke. But this is when you can, I think, start trying to find those kernels of truth as teams actually try to figure out how they have their players stacked.
Well, John, you know, I can only say this. I was taught many, 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 many years ago that even your mother will lie to you when you get close to the draft.
Of course.
Because that's the kind of espionage that has to go on. So much is at stake for these organizations when they make these picks, especially nowadays. It's just become totally cutthroat to the point where so much BS is out there, and it has to be because guys are now, it's not just I'm going to protect what it is that we know or what we want to say, but we also now have to make sure we throw out a misdirection. So, you know, I don't know that I'm really going to believe anything that I've heard in the next 3 weeks.
Well, you know, Lance, people are positioning for trades. They don't want other teams to know what they're thinking to maximize their ability to move around the draft, too, which is a big part of this.
Well, I think a lot of it is agenda-driven between the teams, the agents, the players.
Yeah,
everybody has some type of investment in all of this. So, you know, clients want to help their own causes. Teams want to have misdirection because they want to maybe see a player fall to them. Or other teams want to pull a fast one on another one. So I don't really know if there's a great deal of stock or substance to put into this time period compared to what we're hearing about 3 weeks. My goal is let's just get as close to the draft as humanly possible. Let's get this process over with. Because I think the buildup sometimes is a bit of overkill because of the analysis of determining, does the team actually truly believe that this player is legit, or are they just throwing things out there to create some misdirection?
Remember, teams will only leak information if it's beneficial to them, right? That's why they leak information. No one's going to leak information because it hurts them. So, to your point, Lance, all the information that's put out there is put out there for a reason, whether it's true or false, and that should always be taken into consideration.
Well, unless, though, keep in mind, it's an agent that represents a player.
That's true, too.
And they think maybe if they speak negatively of another player at the same position, you never know that. I mean, it's possible negative information could prove to be beneficial for you.
Well, right, but you're doing it to help yourself. Whether it's negative or positive information, you're putting it out there to help yourself.
Of course, but then it could very well hurt somebody else wrongly because that person didn't do their homework and just took somebody else's word for it. So, you know, that's where it gets into that dangerous territory.
Limited Giants season tickets are on sale now for the 2021 season. In addition to ticket savings, membership benefits include access to exclusive events, experiences, pre-sales, and more. You can lock in your seat starting at just $100. Call 888-NYG-1925 or visit giants.com/tickets for more information. All right, let's take one call before we got Kent Lee Platt coming up here in about 2 minutes. Caller, you're on the line. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Phil from North Carolina.
Phil, what do you got?
Hey, I'll make it fast, and it's my lucky day, I guess. I got three of you guys. Real quick, the PFF came out with this, like, index chart on resources used in the last 10 years for a draft.
I saw that chart.
Position? Did you see that?
I did. That was interesting.
I thought it was fascinating, and it showed that we have, as we know, put a lot of resources. It's like an index, percent index, into, like, tackle position.
Phil, I just want to make sure the callers understand what it is. Basically, they take a look at what spot in the draft teams selected different positions, and they scaled that to show what amount of resources the teams put into different position groups. Is that correct? That's how I read it, at least.
Yes, correct. Okay. It's not just the number, but it's like weighted, obviously, by draft position. Right. So, thanks, John. So given that, and they took all the last 10 years, and it's like in this table, graded table, you can see all the teams, all the positions, you know, it's an XY grid thing. And you can follow, and you can see where we have, you know, relative to everybody else. And I think we were, like, really high, if I can recall, it was like this morning I looked at it. It was really high for offensive tackles, right? Because we had a lot of picks over the years that didn't pan out. I think besides the Thomas and Pert one, you know, the only really decent pick we had was just Pugh, right? And then he wound up being a guard. And then the other thing, you know, running back, we were fairly high because of the Saquon pick compared to the other teams. And we were low in one area, edge rushers. And I found that really interesting. Our resources have been really poor in edge rushers compared to these other teams. So it's a fascinating table. And I found it really interesting because you're comparing it to the other teams. So I just thought I'd bring that to your attention and to the reviewers. Attention.
No, I appreciate it. Good call, Phil. And I think what people do forget, guys, and I think Phil makes a good point, while there's been a lot of complaints about the offensive line, it doesn't mean that the team hasn't put resources into it. In the last 10 years, they've used 3 first-round picks on offensive tackles, Andrew Thomas, Pugh, and, of course, Eric Flowers. They used, I think Beattie was before the last 10 years, so he's not in that mix. But they used a second-round pick on Weston Richburg. They used a third-round pick on Matt Parrott. So they've used a lot of resources in the offensive line. They just haven't, quite frankly, drafted the right guys, which has been what's bit them in the you-know-what.
Well, the other thing that I think is important to take into consideration, I didn't see this chart that you're talking about, but every year the draft changes because of the substance of a given position. So I don't know if those trends really say much of anything. For example, you go three straight years, you just don't think the offensive line class is good. I'm just throwing out a hypothetical. So therefore, you avoid drafting that position because you're just not fond of that position. And that may have been a reason why you didn't use your resources on that. For example, the caller brought up pass rusher. So maybe you didn't think for a few drafts that there was a lot of substance there. So you avoided addressing that position. I think you got to take that into consideration as opposed to just watching what a team addressed or didn't do. I think there's a lot of factors that go into
that. Yeah, the bottom line is, Lance, and you're right, the chart, the numbers, not worth a hill of beans because you have to peel back the layers of the onion to find all of the specific reasons in each case as to why guys were or were not picked. Things can be taken out of context anytime you want and just throw a number or a chart against the wall and say, well, this is the conclusion that I draw. That's just fool's gold.
Well, the other thing that I would add, Paul, is also where you pick every year in the draft.
Without a
is
doubt.
Going to dictate, right, what you're going to address. So if you're a team, you consistently picked in the top five, okay, maybe there's something to take away from that, Paul, because I would argue you're always every year going to have access to the top-tier guys. Mm-hmm. But if you're fluctuating between pick 12 to 25, that's a lot of selections that is going to vary based on how you evaluate players at different positions. So once again, I think I'd have to know more data to really have a true takeaway there.
Well, that's the whole point. You have to be able to peel back the layers.
Anyway. All right, let's go back to our next guest, guys, and he is Kent Lee Platt. You can find him on Twitter at MathBomb. He does all the relative athletic scores. You see me retweet them over the course of the month, guys, and he compiles all of the measurements and testing data for all these players at their pro days to figure out exactly how they stand in that regard compared to players. I think he's up to 25 years now. Kent, you got John Schmelk, Lance Meadow, and Dottino here. We're up to 25 years now, right? You have gone back to 87 or 86?
87, yeah, 35 years now.
35. See, I can't believe that's 35 years ago. It makes me feel even older. all right, Kent, let's start here before we start going into the individual players because I think it's important to either myth bust or myth affirm something that we've been saying and a lot of other people have been saying over the course of this period. Are we seeing overly inflated athletic testing because players are only going about their business with these tests at their pro days instead of doing so at the combine? You have all the data. You've seen all the numbers for 35 years. Are the numbers this year out of whack, or should we be trusting them?
I don't think they're as out of whack as people think they are. What we're getting is a little bit of different data, and it's spread out over a longer period of time. So instead of having all the guys run really fast at the combine, it's happening two or three, four or five times a week, every week over the course of 2 months. So that perception is there that we're getting all these really inflated times. And because we're getting stuff that's from the pro days, we're getting it from the media or from the players themselves. We're not getting it from the official numbers that are actually sent to the NFL team. So the perception is a lot bigger than what we're actually going to end up seeing at the end of the season. I actually just did a lookup for how many people ran a sub 4.4, for example. And there was more this year than last year, but there was less than 2019 and 2018.
Really?
So it's not really as bad as people are making it out to be. It's just because everything is spread out. And it's also due in part to the fact that three of the position groups are just really, really athletic. The offensive tackles, the wide receivers, and the cornerbacks specifically. And we're getting really buffed up numbers for those groups. And it makes it seem like the overall group as a whole is really beefed up when it's just really strong position groups that have a lot of elite tier athletes in it.
Ken, I want to follow up on that really quickly. Should we do a uniform, all right, add a 0.05 of a second to everyone's 40 time or 0.03 maybe if it's less than people think? Or is this really dependent on the school? Like I had Brian Broaddus, he's going to be on the John Soto podcast next week, and he literally told me Ohio State's 40-yard dash at that pro day is going downhill. it's literally on a decreasing vertical, which is why guys run faster on it. So how do we view that? Should we, you know, take certain schools with a raised eyebrow? Should it be everyone that we say, all right, maybe it's a little bit inflated? Or is it just, you know what, take them as a comparison, use them the best you can, and just kind of roll that way? And by the way, let me throw another thing, too, in there that Brian mentioned to me, and you can answer both parts of this. He even thinks like arm measurements are different because at Combine, the same guy measures all the arms. And at these pro days, it's always a different scout. And they might be taking the measurements at different places on the shoulder. And that could even mess up things like arm length.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because I haven't brought that up on my Twitter feed at all. But that's been the biggest metric I've had to update from pro days versus like the Senior Bowl or the CTS All-Star game. Is arm length, because it's done differently. And we've talked about it previously in other years about how it's different from the Senior Bowl to the Pro Day to the Combine. You know, it's just done differently. You don't usually hear people talking about it, but it is different. The 40-yard dash, you know, if you were to average all of the times, like I've done that before. I averaged all the times, and it ends up being a 0.07 adjustment on average between guys who ran at the Pro Day and the Combine both. And then 0.1 for line, 0.07 for skill position. But that's an average. That's taking everybody who's ever done it over a period of, you know, 35 years or however long I have the pro day data to. And that's not really fair to the players because some schools are really, really close. Some schools are even slower at their pro day than they are at the combine.
Really? Interesting.
So for myself, I don't make any adjustments to it, and I don't think it's fair to just add a blanket adjustment for any player. Because it is different. There are some schools that run a little bit faster. Ohio State, you mentioned, was one. LSU is one that usually had faster numbers in the past. But another thing that's changed a lot is a lot of these schools have went from doing straight hand times to doing laser timing of their own. They started doing laser timing and incorporating that into how they do their pro days. And it started to narrow. That difference between pro day and combine has started to narrow some years back. And then 2020 happened, and everything went crazy, and now it's all messed up, and we have no real point of comparison over the last two seasons. But over the previous five seasons or so, it had really started to narrow between the combine and the pro days, both in the raw averages and in the differences between guys that did both tests. So it's one of those things where you take it into account, the numbers that you get, and then you can make an adjustment if you feel like there needs to be one. But I don't think it's fair to just do a blanket adjustment for players because a lot of these guys, that's their actual time.
Well, Kent, I think to feather off of what you were just talking about in terms of narrowing the wide range of results in each of these events, shall we say, doesn't it just make more sense? And I know it's really come to the forefront because of what we've had to deal with the pandemic this past year. But doesn't it make more sense for there to be a standardized, okay, we're going to measure from wrist bone to wrist bone for wingspan. We're going to measure head to the, you know, the top of the crown. We're going to, you know, some of these things seem very simplistic. It wouldn't be so hard for everybody to say, okay, these are the standard ways we're going to measure all this stuff, and everybody follow them. I mean, or is it simply that at every pro day, there's going to be some homer there who wants to cheat for his guys, and there's nothing you can do about it?
Yeah, and it's funny you bring that up too, man, because I've been saying that same type of thing for years. The whole process for the combine and pro days, it's standardized, but only to a point, and some of these things are so simple. But another thing people have to realize is that, like, all this stuff gets written on actual pieces of paper. All the metrics that guys are doing at the pro days just gets written on a piece of paper. A scout gets a printed out piece of paper, and then they will write their own times on it. And it leads to some weird situations. We had a player this year who measured in at 6'3", I think, at his school. When his pro day testing came out, it came out as 6'6", which is 3 inches taller. That's weird. And then we find out later, no, it was 6'2". It's just that whoever wrote it down has really bad handwriting.
Wow. You know,
that seems like a silly thing that we should be dealing with in 2021, right? It seems like something that should be standardized to a point. Somebody needs to have a laptop on scene to just type this stuff in or do it on your phone. You know, it just seems like it should be easier by this point. But there isn't really a standardized process. I'd love to see the NFL develop an app that they would provide to scouts to actually enter that information in so that it can be stored in the database and people could compile that information that way. I think there's a market for that that the NFL is leaving untapped at this time.
It would be interesting to see how much security they add to that app, though, in fairness.
Right?
Because I'm sure people would want to get their hands on that information and tweak and twist and turn it. But it is certainly a valid point. Well, speaking of compiling numbers, I mean, you obviously have been doing that for some time. And I want to expand on your relative athletic scores, because if I have this correct, you do it on a scale from 0 to 10, 10 being obviously the most efficient athleticism, and then obviously the lower your number, the least efficient. When you look at this draft class, and I know you alluded to this somewhat, which position would you say jumps off the page based on your numbers as you've compiled all of the athletic metrics?
Yeah, that's easily the offensive tackle class. This offensive tackle class was already geared up to be really, really strong, but I don't think people realize just how athletic some of these guys are. Spencer Brown out of Northern Iowa actually got that perfect 10 this year. He took it away from Taylor Lewan, who had had it from some years back. And Spencer Brown is a ridiculous athlete. If you go out and look at some of the videos of some of the athletic feats this guy is able to do, it's nuts. And it's one of those things where if you ask, are the numbers legit? Yeah, I mean, go look at the dude on tape and see the stuff, the physical stuff that he can do, and try to gauge that against other 310-plus-pound guys. It's crazy. But if he hadn't have gotten it, Sam Cosmi out of Texas would have got it. Sam Cosmi's now number two overall all time. We've got guys like Brady Christensen out of Brigham Young, Kevin Jenkins out of Oklahoma State, Rashawn Slater out of Northwestern. Penei Sewell out of Oregon is one of the most athletic 330-pound guys we've ever seen. And it's funny because he came out with an 8.98 RAS, which is really, really good. That's an excellent score. And people are like, gosh, he's been talked up so much. I don't know if that's high enough. It's like, that's still really awesome.
Yeah, so let's stick with the offensive line then, because one thing I think has been interesting, and it's kind of why I brought up the arm length before, Kent, is while the testing for these offensive tackles has been great, the one thing that's jumped out to me, last year, all four guys at the top of the class, Becton, Wills, Wirfs, Thomas, all had 34-inch-plus arms. This year, the offensive tackle class, no one's really hit 34 inches in the at the top of this class. Everyone's been either around 33, that's Slater and Sewell. Other guys have been in the 32s that, you know, Eichenberg, I think, was at 32.5, and I think Tevin Jenkins was about the same. So how much do you think that is a product of the measurement stuff we talked about? Or do you think these guys just don't happen to have as long of arms? And in your history, how much has that really dictated success based on your numbers and success factor for these tackles in the pros?
I think it's more of the latter, what you were mentioning, that if some of these guys just don't really have that long of arms. Because even before they tested, guys like Slater, and you mentioned Jenkins, a couple of other guys, they had already talked about arm length potentially being a problem because their length shows up on tape. When you're watching an offensive tackle, it's not just looking for the athletic traits. There's a lot of technical stuff you're looking for when you're scouting an offensive tackle. One of the best examples that we have of that is Orlando Brown, who tested like really bad a couple of years ago. But he had really long arms. And if you watch him on tape, you can see how he uses his length to beat guys on the edge. He's able to get his hands on them fast enough and able to use that length to maneuver guys around. And that's how he wins. That's not something that's tested with the other drills. The guys in this class, there aren't a whole lot of guys that win like that. A lot of these guys win because they're really swift on their feet, or they're like Sewell, who's just huge and athletic. Like for a guy the size of Sewell is nuts to see how that guy can move. But the length doesn't really come into it as much. But that's also why you hear some guys potentially moving inside the guard. We've seen that with Rashawn Slater, with Tevin Jenkins. Elijah Vera Tucker from Southern California is viewed as a guard by a lot of people. A lot of these guys that don't have those longer arms, they start getting looked at as inside guys because that length is less of an issue once you're inside, because you're generally not trying to outbeat guys that are faster than you on the outside, where that wingspan, that length becomes more of an issue. I think it's a case-by-case thing. I don't think that you can really measure somebody out or knock somebody off just because of a short arm. Joe Thomas famously had shorter than average arms. And Joe Thomas had a pretty decent career as an offensive tackle.
Kent, this may be taking you too deep into the forest, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Based on your RAS scores, is there one guy who really sticks out at you that you're saying, this guy is a sleeper that nobody's talking about, and I just think his numbers are going to translate big time into the NFL? And is there a guy on the opposite end of the spectrum who everybody's talking about, and you're saying to yourself, my RAS score says this guy's going to disappoint a lot of people.
Yeah, and I'll start with the second one just because I already have the tackles up. But we had two tackles that didn't test very well that were expected to be higher draft picks. This was Jalen Mayfield out of Michigan and James Hudson out of Cincinnati. I mentioned Orlando Brown before and how he didn't test very well, but he still found success in the NFL. What's different with these two guys is on tape, you see how they win. It is with being their athleticism. They're good athletes on tape, and they tend to beat guys that way. So not testing well is a bit of a bigger red flag for guys like Mayfield and Hudson, because that's how they win on the field. And if they don't test like that, the question becomes why? What's the reason that they didn't test as well? Is there an injury that you have to be worried about? Are they just not as athletic as you thought they were? Or is there some other way that they're winning that maybe necessarily isn't covered in the numbers? So that's the guys that I think might have a little bit more of a struggle. As far as the other end of the spectrum, guys that are sleepers, there's so many in this class because the tackle and the receivers and the corner class are just so good. Guys that aren't really thought of as early picks, Josh Imadorbebe out of Illinois is one of the most explosive players in this class. He had a 46.5-inch vertical, which is the best number for any wide receiver in my database. It's also insane to think of a guy that can jump that high. His broad jump was also 11'2", which is 99th percentile, which is, again, crazy numbers. He reminds me a little bit of Donovan Peoples-Jones, who came out of Michigan a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going to jump in and year one be this number one receiver, but I think if a team can really find a way to tap into that athleticism, he's a player that could cause some problems just because it's really hard to beat an explosive player that's got some decent size. Another player that really stands out is Jalen Camp out of Georgia Tech. He ended up with a 9.75 RAS. And again, that's a scale of 0 to 10. And the wide receivers, I have more than 2,000 receivers in my database. So 97th percentile out of 2,000 guys is crazy high. He's another guy that comes in with really good size. He benched 30 reps. Wide receivers don't usually do the bench press, but he put up 30 on the bench, which is kind of crazy for a guy that's going to be pushing people around at the line. I don't think he's going to get drafted high either, but it's one of those guys that a team's going to take a risk on in the day three and try to really push them up into the ranks, try to develop them into a player, just because the traits are so good and there's so much that you can see there that's worth developing and trying to build up as far as being an NFL player. The defensive backs have a lot of really big names on it that scored well that aren't like big names in like first or second round consideration. One of the guys that's has been rising up a lot of boards is Robert Rochelle out of Central Arkansas. He came in with a 9.65 out of 10 for his RAS, which is really, really good. But he's got really good explosion, really good agility, and really good speed. The only real knocks on him were that he didn't bench that well, and he's not over 6 foot. He's got decent size, but he wasn't one of those really big, lengthy guys. And length occasionally shows up as a problem on tape with him. But those kind of athletic traits on a guy that can play man or zone is just really valuable. And I think some team is going to pick him either late day two or early day three and really get a keeper that they can develop on the field.
Ken, I want to go to the opposite end of the spectrum as opposed to the sleepers, maybe players that could be in the mix for the Giants at the 11th overall pick, because I'm looking at your numbers and no surprise, Patrick Surtain had a very high RAS, as well as Micah Parsons, two guys that could very well be there at 11. I'm curious, when you have a player that is extremely versatile, like a Micah Parsons, who could be moved around, maybe mixed and matched, and there's a number of players that fall into that category in this draft. I'll bring in Isaiah Simmons from last year's class, where you say, okay, the guy's athletic, but wherever he winds up, the team needs to have a good read about how they're going to utilize him. I'm just curious, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but based on the data that you've compiled, when you have a player that fits into that ultra-athletic category, what have the numbers shown in terms of where they project on the NFL level and the level of success they have if there's really no ideal game plan of where to put them based on a position?
Yeah, and coaching plays a really big part in that, because regardless of whether a guy's a versatile player or if they're just locked into a single position, coaches have to have a plan for him. We saw that a little bit with Isaiah Simmons last year, where it didn't really seem early in the season like they had much of a plan for him, and he struggled a little bit. If you have a guy like Micah Parsons, and Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah from Notre Dame is another good example, very similar to how Simmons was used. You know, NFL teams have to have a really clear plan for what they want that guy to do when he gets to the NFL. It's becoming more common. I think we're going to see more guys like that that have multiple positions that they can play on the field. I tend to be a fan of throwing them in one position, developing them in one position, and then trying to ease them into another position as you go. I think that's a better plan for developing a rookie in the NFL. The learning curve is so high, even from a big school, the learning curve is very large going from college to the pros. And trying to ease somebody into one position versus multiple at the same time, you know, I think that's better for long-term development. Especially if you have a weaker roster and you're picking higher up in the draft, you don't have all the pieces in place to have the luxury of having a guy that can move all around the line. You know, if you have a guy like Parsons can play middle linebacker, he can play outside linebacker, he can play a little bit on the edge. That's all well and good, but if you don't have another edge that can rush the passer, then when you're putting him on the linebacker spot, then you don't have the pass rusher. You're making it harder on him at the linebacker spot. And if you don't have a linebacker and you put him on the edge, now you have a hole in the middle of your field because you're moving a good linebacker to an edge position, and it becomes a weakness for your defense rather than a strength. So it's helpful to try to have a very clear plan and to see the team try to execute that plan, which from a fan's perspective, it just means don't write them off because they're not some versatile piece from day one. Sometimes it's just the coach trying to develop them in one area so that they can get strong enough in it, they don't have to worry about it, and then develop them in another and try to build them at that. And to the same respect, if they don't and they try to use them at multiple positions at once, there's going to be some struggle. You're just going to have to live with that and know that if the plan works out and the player develops and they are a good enough player to develop, eventually all those holes will start to shore up and will start to be fixed.
Final question for me, Ken. And I want you to focus in on the edge class here, but if there's other positions you think it applies to, please, I would love to hear it. What are some of the specific traits for a position or two that you think either puts up a big green flag or red flag when it comes to drafting? I know traditionally, like, the three-cone drill is supposed to be very important for edge rushers, for example. But take it anywhere else you want to, you know, that one, the one trait or a testing number that just is so key for a position, and then maybe some of the guys that, you know, either raised a big green or red flag for you with that trait at that position. And I would like you to touch on the edge class in the answer too, because I think that's kind of a bit of a jumbled group this year with a lot of people having a lot of different opinions.
Yeah, and it really depends on what the player's job is. You know, we have this problem, and I have this too with Raz. Raz has very traditional position groupings, and there's some guys that just don't fall into that traditional mold. But whenever you're looking at a player, you try to look at how they win. You mentioned the three cone. Having a sub-7 three cone is one of those magic numbers. NFL teams love when a pass rusher has a sub-7 three cone. It's one of the best traits that you can have. But that's assuming that your guy's going to be on the outside and he's going to be bending that edge. If you have a guy like Za'Darius Smith, who plays for the Packers, you know, Za'Darius Smith isn't a really bendy guy, but that's also not how he wins. He wins because he's really large and he's powerful. He's able to win on the inside and use his explosiveness to beat offensive tackles and to push them back and break on the inside. That doesn't make him a bad pass rusher because he doesn't have some elite three cone, because his job doesn't really require it. So when you're looking at a pass rusher, you want to look at how they win on the football field and then how they test. If a guy's a speed rusher on the edge, yes, you really want a good three cone. And if they don't have a good three cone, that could be potentially problematic, because that's where you want them to win, is showing that ability to bend and get around corners really fast. If you have a guy that's more powerful and likes to blast guys into the backfield, or if he's one of those guys that has that explosive first step and he beats guys right off the line when the ball is snapped, you're looking more towards your broad and your vert to see, does he have that explosiveness that's really going to show that he can get off the line in the NFL. Other positions where it becomes really important, offensive linemen having a 4-4 shuttle or better is one of those magic numbers. Regardless of where they're drafted, and if an offensive lineman has a 4-4 shuttle or better, their chances of seeing a football field is extremely good. And again, regardless of draft position, whether they're drafted in the first round or the sixth or seventh, it's one of those really valuable traits that helps NFL coaches develop a player to be a potential starter in the NFL. But some offensive linemen don't win because they're quick and agile. I mentioned Brown using his length earlier, but there's a lot of guys that win just because they're explosive off the line. So again, you're looking at your explosiveness drills or your 10-yard split. It's the same thing with receivers. If a guy wins with speed, you want him to have a good 40 time. If he wins with speed and he runs a poor 40 time, that's a red flag. You want to pay attention to it. One of my favorite positions that I've started to study more in depth is safety. Generally, you want a really athletic, rangy is the big word that you hear. You want a rangy safety, a guy that can burst across the football field. But it's not necessarily the 40 time that you're looking at. And that's one of those misconceptions that gets blown up a lot, is that if he doesn't run a good 40 time, he's not rangy, he's not fast. But on a football field, if a safety has a good 10-yard split and good explosiveness drills and agility drills, but maybe a poor 40, he runs a 4.63, 4.65, something like that. But his 10 split and his other drills are all good. That's generally a guy that you can develop into a good safety, because when you're that far back, the trick is being able to react to a play quickly and get to a spot, right? To break off and be that safety net to prevent a runner from getting too far. And if a safety is explosive and quick, they can get running faster than somebody who's already, or than somebody who maybe takes a little bit longer to get going, even if they have a good 40 time. So speed is not necessarily just how far can you run in a straight line. It's how quick you can get from one point to another. And if you don't have a good 40 time, but you're explosive and the player is smart enough to catch those plays as they're happening, you can cover a lot of ground that makes up for having a poor 40 just by being explosive and quick.
Kent, I feel we are obligated to ask you about the one player in this draft who has been talked about as the biggest matchup nightmare of the class, and that is tight end Kyle Pitts, who Fiegels, myself, I think Lance and John are on the same page. He's the dream pick for the Giants at 11. He won't get there. We know that. But this guy is basically the talk of the draft outside of Trevor Lawrence. When you looked at his RAS, and I have it up here on my computer, I see shuttle, three cone, and vertical, and bench, all with yellow flags, and weight with a red flag. I'm curious what your thoughts were when you first put that little chart together for him, being that he is so overwhelmingly regarded as the biggest threat, athletic demon, matchup nightmare of anybody in this class.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry so much about the weight. You know, this database goes back 35 years, and tight ends are a lot bigger than people think of now, because we've seen guys like George Kittle and Kelsey and all these guys that are coming out now that are quicker and they're a lot smaller. That's a relatively new phenomenon. That's not something that's been going on for 10, 15 years. It's something that's only crept up in recent years. So I wouldn't worry so much about the weight. 245 is perfectly fine for a tight end. Coming out in today's NFL. And I think he'll put on a little bit. I think he'll probably play around 255 by year two. The only real flag that I would consider in his profile is his vert. 33.5-inch vert is not that great. It's fine, but it's not that great when you have a guy like Pitts who wins by out-jumping people, who wins by out-bodying people. But that brings me to how he wins against that. You know, I mentioned length before with offensive linemen. Kyle Pitts has the best, his shoulders, his arms, everything, his whole length, his wingspan, that's the word I was looking for, has the best wingspan of any player ever at a skill position. And for a guy that can jump at least plenty good, that wingspan is going to really come into play, because it's not just can you outjump somebody, it's can you put enough distance between yourself and the person who's trying to block you. And if you have that kind of size, I don't think that vertical is too much of a red flag, because he's still able to body out two or three guys at a time playing at Florida. Mentioning Florida, Florida is actually one of those schools that has an average slower 40 time at their 40-yard dash than they did at the combine. So when you see his 4.44.40, that's legit. I have no reason to doubt that based on Florida's history. Florida is one of those schools where their 40 is almost dead on or slower. So it's not something to be concerned about. His agility times actually surprised me. I didn't think he would test as well as he did in his agility. He's a good route runner, and he's quick enough, but that's not really how he wins. He wins because he bodies out people, and he's so good at it, and his hands are so good, and his speed is so good. He really is a matchup nightmare, and I think a lot of the things that we're looking at with flags on his athletic profile are kind of quibbling, because they don't point to things that would cause him a problem with how he wins on a football field. And again, most of those marks, you know, they're yellow flags. They're not the elite mark, but they're still plenty good enough. You know, his lowest yellow one is still 68th percentile, his shuttle. You know, that's better than most players in the NFL that are going to be playing the tight end position.
Yeah, so you will reassert he's not getting to 11.
He is not getting to 11. I mean, there's like five teams before that have him penciled in as their pick.
And by the way, just for the record, he did come in at a 96th percentile in terms of all tight ends. Just for fun, Kent, did you put him into the wide receiver metric to see where he would pop out with that?
I did, and you can actually do that yourself now. I added that feature beneath the card. So if you're a player, you can do change him right beneath the card. He came in at 90, almost 94th percentile, 9.39 RAS, at wide receiver.
That's ridiculous.
So, fine. You don't have to worry about that. His agilities are poor, so you probably shouldn't draft him in the first 10 picks or so. You should follow
yeah,
him.
Yeah, okay. Tell the rest of the league that so he slips, okay? Do us a favor.
I'm on it.
Kent, really good stuff, man. We really appreciate the time. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure talking to you every year. Tell the folks where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your relative athletic score database.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at MathBomb. I'm on there all the time talking about metrics. I'm posting these cards between now and all the way up to the draft. You can look up any player you want. And as I said, you can change their position at relativeathleticscores.com. You can also find me at Pro Football Network. I'm the analytics director and the head of applications development there. You can go over there and try that mock draft simulator that they have there for free. I hope to hear from all of you guys and let me know what you guys hope your G-men do for the draft.
Look forward to it, Kent. Good stuff, my friend. Let's talk soon.
Thanks, Kent.
Thank you.
That's Kent Lee Platt. Does a fantastic job. The old Super Mario Brother bomb logo, that's his Twitter profile picture. So go check that out. So, Paul, Lance, were you guys a little bit surprised that he pointed out that, you know what, these pro day scores, you should probably take them a little bit more seriously than maybe we've been describing them?
Yeah, I mean, look, I understand that, and I think that it was a bit surprising to find out that the variance wasn't as wide because, John, look, you and I have been doing these pro day videos for the Giants.com website now for what, almost a month? And every time we sit down to start doing these things, we look at these times and we're like, okay, 4-3, 4-4, 4-2, 4-3-5, 4-4-1. It almost seems like we're going through a litany of guys who are like the Flash. And so I was, yeah, he kind of threw some cold water on that because it just seemed like the numbers were too incredible to believe on a regular basis. That would be my takeaway.
Yeah, I almost feel like it's a psychological experiment, right, Lance? When you have all these guys doing it on the same day at the same time, you lose some of the impact of each one of the 4-4 speeds. But when it's all spread out and you get like one or two a day, it's a lot easier to notice, and I think it's kind of like a weird psychological experiment that's been put on the entire NFL scouting community here and how they react to it being spread out instead of it all happening in a couple days at the combine.
Well, and also because of the fluctuation in terms of who's taking the measurements and so forth, which is what Kent brought up. I thought actually his much larger point, which is probably the bigger takeaway from all these pro day numbers, is look to what the player is going to be doing on the NFL level and then adjusting your viewpoint of the measurements to that. So, for example, if he's a guy that wins with a jump ball, okay, the vertical takes on a little bit more importance. If he's a guy that wins with speed, the 40 is much more important. But if you're not asking him to use those characteristics to do what he does on the football field, then I think there's lesser stock and substance behind those numbers. That's why, to me, you've got to look at the measurement individually based on what the player is expected to do, not just one measurement applies equally to all. I thought that point is something that should be applied moving forward, and that should be more a part of the conversation when we evaluate prospects.
Lance, really, all that is a microcosm of one of my mantras forever, and that is styles make fights. It's all about matchups. And it's not about what this guy does. It's about how does he match up against the guy across from him? Or how does that line match up? Or how does that team match up? Styles make fights. That's what this is all about. It's always been about that. It's never been about the linear numbers.
And that's why Ken is one of Paul's math guys that he actually likes.
Yeah, right? Because he recognizes that.
Well, context. That's what he adds to the conversation. It's not just taking a number on the surface and then running crazy with it. I mean, if you look on social media, a guy runs a 4.3 and then everybody all of a sudden thinks he's the greatest thing since Swiss cheese. And we've seen that. We've seen very fast guys and they don't pan out to be anything on the NFL level. So you can run very quickly. When they put the helmet on you and the pads and the jersey and they add another person on your body, let's see now truly how fast and how effective you are. That separates the men from the boys.
Mm-hmm. You don't hear greatest things since Swiss cheese very often. You must be a big Swiss cheese fan, Lance.
No, it's just
a
unique
Swiss cheese?
Type of cheese. Well, no, when it first appeared with the holes in it and so forth, people reacted accordingly. So that's
Mozz
why it's a big
and provolone
part of
are so much better. It's not even close.
Well, I wasn't expecting you to be a fan of Swiss cheese, okay, Mr. Italian Stallion over there, all right? I'm not surprised in terms of your take. But I'm just
little
explaining.
Little pecorino romano is pretty damn good on the pasta.
That would
too.
Not be on the menu when it comes to the Datino household. I would
all
not
right,
expect Swiss cheese to be the first choice.
All right, yes. Final thing before you say goodbye. Give me the one thing you guys are trying to figure out in your head or thinking about with 3 weeks until the draft.
Wow. Only one?
Yeah, just give me the one major thing that you're still trying to work through.
I still can't figure out if it's going to be five quarterbacks in the top 10 or four.
Okay.
A lot of people are thinking it could be five. I'm just not so sure it will get to five.
Lance?
Well, on a related note, I'm fascinated by what the San Francisco 49ers choose to do because I think San Francisco's in a very interesting spot where they have to anticipate that the Jets are going to take a quarterback that maybe they're enamored with, and Kyle Shanahan is a very creative thinker. Do they actually go outside of the quarterback position despite the fact that they moved up? I think that's a fascinating thing to at least think about over these next few weeks.
All right, this is where I'm at. And this is kind of, it's almost a conclusion. It's going to take a lot for someone to convince me not to select one of the top wide receivers or offensive linemen on the board when the Giants pick at 11. It's going to take a lot of convincing for me to get off of that. I don't know which one of those six players, and I'm including Kyle Pitts in that, is going to be available. And of course, I'm talking about Kyle Pitts, Ja'Marr Chase, Devontae Smith, Jalen Waddle, Rashawn Slater, Penei Sewell. If one of those six players are there, I'm picking them. And it's going to take a lot of convincing, maybe from Datino, maybe from Lance, maybe from Fegels, to pick one of those, not one of those guys, if one of them is sitting there for me at 11. And that's kind of where I stand right now.
Well, I guess the debate that you'd be having with yourself then, if I understand you correctly, is the argument to then trade down as opposed to taking a player there.
Well, I mean, I think those guys will be all gone by 13 or 14. So I would not.
Well, more of a reason to then stay put where right. you are because correct. You're going to have at least an attractive choice then.
Right, and I think I'm pretty sure that one of those guys are going to be there. I'm not sure all those guys are going to be wiped out. I think that would be pretty amazing. Now, Daniel Jeremiah did have all offensive players in the first 9 picks of his mock draft that he put up there this week. So if that happens, maybe I'm going to have to pick a defensive player. And right now I'm sitting. If it's my choice between one of those offensive linemen and either Smith or Waddle, I'm picking the offensive lineman. And
you know
I
what,
think
John,
that's where I'm going to stick.
Based on what you just said, you're just begging me to come back with another comment here because, see, I think that's the easy one. To me, the hard one is 42. The easy one is at 11, and that's because we know who the premier players are. We think we know who the top 12 players are by consensus. And as you said, you're looking at a receiver or an offensive lineman in all likelihood because there is such a cluster of elite guys. So it's kind of like whichever guy falls, all right, that's probably going to be the guy. At 42, it could be one of anybody. That is so much more of a mystery to me and so much more of a quandary than 11. 11's a piece of cake.
Well, I think I asked you this question yesterday. You said you would pick one of the defensive players over one of the wide receivers. So it's not that big of a piece of cake then.
Well, No. Surtain is one of the premier 12 for me.
Okay, I know, but that's why I made the statement I made because he's not in that top group with those wide receivers and offensive linemen for me.
Oh, okay, well, then for you, it's an individual decision that's a little bit different than it is for me. For me, right. 42 is a hell of a lot harder than 11.
Of course.
Well,
you
that's because there's 41 guys off the board by that
duh.
Point.
I mean, of course. You don't know who's going to be there, and it depends what you do in the first round, too. Like,
Wait a minute.
If you pick a lineman in the first round, you're not picking another one in the second round.
Of course. Of course.
Are you telling me, is it more challenging, Paul, to make a pick at 19th overall or when you make the 151st selection? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, 151, it's a special teams guy or a guy who fits an RAS profile. That's easy, too. No, 42, the second-round pick. See, the Giants have to hit, okay? They've got to hit on their first three, maybe their first four picks, to be honest with you. They only not – to your point, Lance, you always talk about long-term. You're damn straight. They got to get long-term. But the other thing is, because of the way this team is built, they need immediate production out of their top three picks, maybe their top four. Therefore, second round, third round, those are the ones that are really going to give me agita much more than the pick at 11.
Well, but of course, but we can't have those conversations now because we don't know who's going to be there.
Of course. Of course, you're right.
As we talk in circles.
We have no idea. but that's why it's much harder.
Right. I know, but I'm not going to stress out about that for the next 3 weeks.
But I always stress out.
But
it's what I do.
Yeah, but Paul, we don't even know who we're choosing from. Why are you stressing out about it?
Because I can't help myself.
All your targets could be off the board by that time.
I know.
At least your targets as it stands right now.
Oh, boy. Anyway, but yeah, look, Jeff stated it as simple as can be. I know we're over time here, but he stated it as simple as can be. If you believe there's four quarterbacks gone in the top 10, then the Giants are getting the seventh best player left, which in all honesty should be one of these elite guys. And if there's five taken by that point, then they're going to get the sixth best player who's left. So you pretty much know the Giants are going to the penthouse to get whoever they get at 11. So that really doesn't concern me very much. 42? Who knows what you're going to wind up with 42? You could wind up with O.C. Imanura or Marvin Austin.
Well, right, but I think that 11th pick is also interesting, though, Paul, because that'll dictate it, right? Because if you like, let's say the draft goes a certain way and all your offensive linemen are wiped out by 42, well, then you know what? You should have picked one at 11. And if you didn't, you're screwed. So that's why I think that top pick's important, because you're also trying to anticipate what that thing, what it's going to look like when you get to 42. So that's why I think it's you have to take a lot of that into consideration.
I disagree with that point, but that's okay.
You don't think what you do in the first round impacts what you do in the second round?
No, I don't think when you're talking about the offensive linemen, I think there are playable offensive linemen, especially on the interior, that have a real chance at plug and play in the second and third rounds.
That's not the point. They won't all be gone by 42.
They won't be.
I was making just a theoretical conversation.
Oh, all right. You were getting a little too specific with your hypothesis.
Well, I don't know why you decided to pick a fight on this, Paul. I don't understand.
It's okay. All right. We're fine.
Thank you for being with us, everybody, on this episode.
Let's just pick guys. I'm done with this. Let's just draft today.
Well, you got 3 weeks, Paul.
My God.
And we are going to start doing mock drafts next week, by the way. So make sure you tune in next Friday. We'll have our first mock. And then on Monday, by the way, Jeff Fiegels and I will have Austin Gale from Pro Football Focus. We're also going to have Matt Waldman, who does his RSP portfolio, breaks down all the skill position guys as well. Thank you, Lance. Thank you, Paul.
See you guys.
Enjoy nice weather weekend. We will see you on Monday for a Big Blue Kickoff Live. And don't forget, Giant fans, that our podcast network is presented by Investors Bank. Get a New York Giants checking account from Investors Bank with the Giants branded debit card, security features, and discounts at the Giants online shop. You can earn up to $250 when you open an account at investorsbank.com/Giants, member FDIC. And don't miss out on your chance to experience a premier hospitality experience watching Giant games and world-class concerts in 2021 as a Giants suite partner. Limited full-season locations are available, or place a deposit for individual games. Call 888-NYG-1925 or visit giants.com/suites for more information. For Paul Dottino, for Lance Meadow, I'm John Schmelk. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.